Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And I'm Zachary Kak from Washington.
Today, Zach and I will take a look at two recent topics that have come up in the news. First, we'll focus on Al-Qaeda's opening of a new wing in South Asia and discuss the implications of that and what that tells us about the group's strategy and current place. Following which, we'll take a look at Japan's South Asian diplomacy. We'll take both a look at Narendra Modi's trip, the Indian Prime Minister's trip to Japan, which resulted in several important agreements and also set the tone for India-Japan relations under these two relatively new leaders. Following which, we'll also briefly discuss Abe's trips to Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, which demonstrate Japan's interest in other South Asian states as well. So just to start off with, Zach and I, we're going to take a look at the Al-Qaeda's recent announcement about a new wing in South Asia. So essentially, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda, released a video last week in which he called on Al-Qaeda's affiliates and he called on global Muslims to essentially engage in jihad in South Asia, which he also extended to include Myanmar, Bangladesh, India. He actually mentions by name the Indian state of Gujarat, which is where the current prime minister hails from and where he essentially received some controversy in the media for 2002 protests where hundreds of Muslims died. But Zawahiri doesn't talk about that in much detail. Essentially, this video declares the opening of Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent and calls for Al-Qaeda's brothers to rise up, and essentially he says to Indian Muslims that Al-Qaeda has not forgotten them and is doing what it can to rescue them. So Zach, what's your read on this? I mean, is this a reaction by Al-Qaeda to the recent success that ISIS has had in terms of declaring a global caliphate?
Yeah, I think this again is like mostly Zawahiri and Al-Qaeda Central trying to stay relevant. Obviously, their leadership and their so-called leadership of the global jihad has sort of been curtailed by the successes of ISIS. And it's been a huge blow because they have pretty much very conflicting ideologies in terms of they both want to establish a caliphate, but Al-Qaeda has always said that to do that you have to eliminate the U.S. from the region because it's the U.S. that props up all the Arab Sunni dictators. And ISIS has been more about using sectarian violence to seize power and then from there build the caliphate. So I think this is sort of Swahiri's almost an admission that ISIS is winning in the Middle East, which is the main focus of both groups. And so he's trying to generate support for Al-Qaeda by turning to India, or South Asia and India, where ISIS isn't really active or interested in, at least at this point. So I think that's definitely part of it. The other part that's interesting is, you know, Zawahiri's in Pakistan, which is obviously closer to India than really like the Persian Gulf. So I think that in that sense, it maybe makes sense. He's obviously very limited. I mean, Al-Qaeda Central hasn't really made attack on anywhere in a while. I don't think it really has much capability to move. It's tied down by drone strikes and U.S. intelligence. So I think it may be able more logistically. Zawahiri and Al-Qaeda Central might be more logistically able to threaten India than it can like the middle of the Middle East. And then it's also possible, I think, that Zawahiri fears that Al-Qaeda is right now it's welcome in Pakistan and thinks that if it starts to focus its attention on India, that'll be popular with some of the militant groups in Pakistan as well as the Pakistani military and intelligence forces. What about you? Do you think that's possible?
No, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think it's also important to consider the flip side because we don't really know to what extent, I mean, this announcement was precipitated by ISIS's success because, you know, you have to consider that ISIS essentially came onto the global radar as a major threat in June this year. And plausibly, you know, Al-Qaeda's had interest in South Asia for much longer than that. I mean, something that I've been looking into is that Al-Qaeda could be attempting to seize on an opportunity to India because the Indian Mujahideen were actually their entire leadership was captured by the Indian government, which left several leaderless jihadist militants within India. And from what I've read, Al-Qaeda is supposedly trying to capitalize on that by providing some sort of leadership and structure to those Indian militants and attempting to leverage that also in other states. I mean, obviously, the announcements that referred to Myanmar and Bangladesh aren't don't stem from that same dynamic, but I think it's highly likely that they're trying to, at least in India, make the most of that leadership vacuum in the Indian Mujahideen.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I think, first of all, it's not the first time Al-Qaeda's really kind of reached out to South Asia. They just haven't really had much success in it. So I think that definitely seems plausible to me that he's trying to establish himself as a leader now that there's a little bit of a vacuum. But I think it also highlights the general different nature. There's been reports that ISIS is like threatening China or whatever, but I think in general, there's a key difference between ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and that's that ISIS is very regionally focused, where Al-Qaeda at least aspires to be more of a global threat.
Yeah, but I mean, on the flip side, you look at ISIS's recruiting success. They've been getting fighters everywhere from Indonesia to Europe to the United States to fly across the world to fight with them in Syria and Iraq, which is something that, you know, Al-Qaeda, when it comes to their recruiting, it's always been more clandestine, more sort of on the down low. I mean, ostensibly because of the post 9/11 focus on weeding out Al-Qaeda, it's been more difficult for them. But for ISIS, just this summer, I mean, if I were Zawahiri and watching that, I mean, clearly that shows that, you know, Al-Qaeda is falling behind this other group.
Yeah, but it's also some, I mean, ISIS is more of a, is, you know, it carries out terrorist attacks. It's also an insurgency group that controls territory and stuff, so that makes it easier. When there used to be more Western recruiting in Al-Qaeda when it had its own training camps and safe haven in Afghanistan pre 9/11. So, I mean, but still, ISIS, what Al-Qaeda did was send these Western, they trained the Westerners in Afghanistan and sent them back to carry out attacks or whatever. And ISIS seems to be, I mean, you've seen suicide bombers from a lot of the Western countries, Australia and the U.S. and Europe. And you know, if they're using them as suicide bombers, that means they're, you know, they want them for their regional fight then, rather than, like, they're trying to use them to fight globally. So I think, again, like, there's people, the U.S. and Europe are almost exporting terrorism to Iraq and Syria. That makes it really sounds.
Right, right. Anyways, yeah, I mean, we'll have to see, I mean, where this actually goes. I mean, a lot of Al-Qaeda's announcements in the past have turned out to be hollow, and this could be another one of them. Do you want to take the conversation over to Japan and South Asia now?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So, there's been a lot of activity between Japan and India, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. So most significantly, India and Japan, Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India traveled to Japan where he met with Shinzo Abe, with whom he has a very close personal rapport. A lot of analysts have noted that the two leaders are very similar in terms of where they stand vis-a-vis their own countries. I mean, both are nationalists, both are looking to economically revitalize their countries, and both have a deep mutual admiration for each other. And I think the textbook example that a lot of people picked up on after this visit was a picture of an embrace between Modi and Abe. Generally, in Japanese culture, that's considered a very a sign of, you know, real closeness with someone if you embrace them, if you show that sort of physical closeness to them. So I think a lot of people took that to essentially also shadow a strategic embrace between India and Japan. Now, India and Japan have had a strategic and global partnership since 2006, which they elevated to a special strategic and global partnership. In this case, the modifier special simply just, you know, really means that Abe and Modi want you to know that they're very serious about this bilateral relationship. India doesn't like to take things as far as declaring alliances. It likes to keep its close partnerships described as strategic partnerships. So that's what it's doing in Japan. In terms of agreements, surprisingly, there wasn't really that much that Modi walked back with. But essentially, the major boon that he got for India was a $34 billion guarantee of Japanese development assistance and investment, which is huge for the Indian economy and lets Modi sort of show to both his supporters and his critics that he is sort of delivering on his pre-election pitch, which was that he will bring India's economy back on track and bring foreign investors to the fray. Other major agreements that India and Japan are working on include there's one agreement for Japanese bullet train technology, the Shinkansen, to be imported to Japan. That is still in limbo. Another deal involving the sale of U.S. to amphibious surveillance aircraft. I was actually expecting that agreement to find some sort of resolution this year. It's still possible towards the end of the year, but that again did not end up getting signed during Modi's trip to Japan. And the other issue, which has been a major issue between India and Japan, and probably one of the major separating points between the two countries, is the issue of civil nuclear cooperation. Now, Japan is understandably concerned with India's status outside the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And ever since India signed its agreement with the United States, it's been slowly signing these other civilian nuclear cooperation agreements across the world, especially since it's got a since it gained a waiver from the Nuclear Suppliers Group in 2008. But with Japan, it's still got a ways to go. They're still working out the details on safeguards and other issues. So yeah, that was pretty much, you know, the entirety of what Modi and Abe discussed. And obviously there's a China angle. I mean, so Zach, how do you see these two leaders positioning the bilateral vis-a-vis China? I mean, obviously India is concerned about getting close to China, getting close to Japan at the risk of upsetting China. That's always kind of been a perpetual feature of Indian policy towards Japan, because India does ideally want to have good relations with both these countries. How do you, do you think India is doing a good job of balancing it right now, or could it do more, or could it actually get closer to Japan? Could it do less?
I would think it'd want to do more with Japan. I mean, we got the Xi visit coming up, and we had the Premier League last year. I think India's really been growing closer to China than it has to India. But obviously with the Abe, Abe's always been a big fan of India, and Modi seems amenable to forging stronger ties with Japan. But I mean, like you said, this trip, for all the hype and stuff, didn't really deliver all that much in concrete, tangible achievements. So I think maybe it helps build a personal bond between Abe and Modi, which is important. But it's not like any big sort of thing stuck out at me. I mean, like, and it seems like you agree with that, right?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I mean, I think Japan and India also have a tendency to do a lot of their bilateral business behind the scenes, leaving it to their foreign ministries to essentially whack out the details behind the scenes. They do have annual head of government summits, which is actually very rare for both countries. Japan doesn't even do that with the United States, but it does do that with India. So it's very likely that when the next visit happens next year, which is going to be the flip side, Abe will travel to India, that they might essentially, you know, then sign some of these agreements. But, you know, I mean, like, some of these issues have just been stuck in limbo. Like, the civil nuclear cooperation issue has just been going on for ages and ages, and that's actually a major sticking point between India and Japan that they've had a very tough time reconciling. I mean, especially because negotiations look to be picking up before the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan, which obviously affected how the country viewed the use of nuclear power. That really delayed the entire negotiation process even further.
Yeah, but on that note, Abe does want to increase exports of nuclear. I mean, he's all about the nuclear energy stuff, even if Japan as a nation isn't.
Yeah, that's true. So that's actually a major reason that I've been optimistic about this agreement, because the government, the perspectives of the two government are mostly are probably most in agreement since they have been. I mean, under the DPJ, everything was essentially at a standstill. So this is much better in that regard.
Yeah, I would just note, I mean, there's a lot to be made about how Abe and Modi are the same kind of leaders, and there's certainly a lot of truth to that in terms of this nationalism and this focus on economics and stuff. But at the same time, I see Asia more and more, their leaders being of one of two different kinds. One is maybe the princeling model, we'll call it, where the leaders come from the elite, their parents were like political elites, and you see that in North Korea, South Korea, China, Japan. And then you see it with India too, with not with Modi, but with
the Gandhis,
and you know, basically every leader before Modi. And then you see these like populist leaders that come from nowhere, come outside the elite and rise through their own person. You see that with Indonesia now, with India. You saw it with Iran with Ahmadinejad. You saw it with Thailand before. Before the coup. So I think that it's important to recognize that distinction, whereas that Abe, you know, was born a political elite, basically, and Modi's a self-made man.
Yeah. I wonder how that figures into their mutual interaction. I mean, Modi's made a big point of that during the election campaign, obviously, talking down the Congress party's reliance on the Gandhi family.
Yeah, I'm not saying it expects their relationship in terms of like they look at each other suspiciously because of this, but I just wonder how much, to what extent this affects them as people, and so like they, you know, how their ability to connect to each other, because you know, Abe's coming from being raised in a rich country, being an elite in a rich country, basically, you know, not his whole life, but for most of it. And then Modi's coming from, like, a poorer country and was, you know, on the periphery of society. So I think that – I wonder how well they do actually get along personally.
Yeah. I mean, Abe, I think, makes the most of it. I mean, he doesn't shy away about talking about his grandfather, Kishi. I mean, when he's when Modi visited him, I think he showed him some artifacts that Kishi had received when he traveled to India in the 1950s. So you know, I think Abe makes the most of his heritage when it comes to diplomacy, especially his grandfather's heritage.
Yeah.
But think how odd
that is, because Modi, like you said, ran against, like, this influence of, like, families in India, you know, the Gandhis. And then, like, Abe's like, look at me, like, I rose through, like, my family, basically.
Yeah. I don't know, it's interesting. I do want to talk about a bit about the Bangladesh-Sri Lanka diplomacy as well.
Yeah, you wrote about this, though.
Yeah. So after hosting Modi in Japan for 5 days, Abe wasted no time in returning to South Asia. He conducted a 2-day visit to Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, spending 1 day in each country, meeting with obviously Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina in Bangladesh and Mahinda Rajapaksa in Sri Lanka. So the Bangladesh visit was actually fascinating because both Bangladesh and Japan are up for a non-permanent Security Council seat. And essentially, this was a point of contention before the visit, but when Abe left, he left with a guarantee from Sheikh Hasina that Bangladesh would withdraw its candidacy for the non-permanent seat and instead support Japan. So that was a major coup for Abe. And obviously, the quid pro quo there was development assistance, which Japan has traditionally used as its major lever in when it comes to negotiating and foreign policy. So it extended several millions of yen to Bangladesh for infrastructure projects and investments. And there's a similar story as well in Sri Lanka. So Sri Lanka is, again, an interesting case because China's been making major inroads there with the new president. And Abe is essentially trying to play catch-up. So in Sri Lanka, he also signed agreements for economic cooperation. A new airport terminal will be built in Colombo with $330 million in Japanese financing. But apart from that, there's an interesting maritime security angle between Japan and Sri Lanka, which we saw earlier this year. Earlier in the summer, a Japanese admiral of the Maritime Self-Defense Force visited Sri Lanka to discuss maritime cooperation, counter-piracy, and anti-terrorism. And Abe apparently is he allegedly followed up on that discussion, discussing maritime security with Sri Lanka. The details on that remain a bit fuzzy, but it looks like Japan and Sri Lanka might look to deepen their maritime cooperation. And that makes good sense from Japan's perspective, since Japan is a huge energy importer and relies from imports that traverse the Strait of Hormuz and the Indian Ocean, and Sri Lanka is obviously sitting right there on those sea lanes. So by fostering close relations with both India and Sri Lanka, Japan will have better guarantees that its Indian Ocean traffic will not be interdicted.
Yeah, and I think it's also China right now is trying to create this whole infrastructure bank and just kind of building this new maritime road or whatever. And so it's investing a lot, and I think Japan just trying to counteract that because Japan relies a lot on these countries. At least the maritime part of their energy supplies. It's also important to note, I think, that Sri Lanka recently settled its maritime disputes with India. I don't know if that was even mentioned in the trip, but I just think it's interesting they visited so soon afterwards. I would think Abe would be highlighting that all over the place, but
Yeah. Well, so what I find actually interesting with his diplomacy is that following the collective self-defense resolution in Japan, Abe has been making a point of having foreign leaders that he speaks to essentially declare their support for Japan playing a more active defense role. For example, with both Rajapaksa and Sheikh Hasina, he got statements – I mean, essentially, you know, the media made a big deal about the fact that both of these leaders backed a more active role for Japan in the Asian Security Order. And I think that's actually going to be a major part of Abe's diplomacy going forwards. A lot of Beijing's criticism following the reinterpretation of the Constitution was that essentially, you know, Japanese militarization is on the rise. Nobody really backs a stronger Japanese role because everybody in Asia has this sort of painful historical memory of Japanese imperialism. But a lot of these South Asian countries don't. So I think that's smart on Abe's part to get these declarations. Obviously, it's not as good as getting a declaration from neighboring countries like South Korea, but it's still something.
No, I think it's really important because, more and more, it's increasingly just Korea and China that have this this, I mean, not like other countries aren't mad about what happened during World War II, but they're, it's increasingly those two that are expressing concern about Japan's, you know, changes today and like Japan taking a bigger, larger role in the region. A lot of these countries have a very strong interest in on helping to balance China with Japan or whatever. So I think that he's taking advantage of that, which is smart.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyways, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more.